Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Mr. Cole Horn today.
Hello there.
Ms. Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
And Mr. Chris Casso.
Hello.
All right. And we are here in the lovely Comics Dungeon in beautiful downtown Wallingford, a neighborhood of Seattle. How's everybody doing this evening?
Good.
Lovely.
Yeah, I'm fine.
All right, I'm kind of recovering because I saw the new Fantastic Four movie a couple days ago, and we're going to talk about that in a sec. I want to build up to
I've had like a week and a half.
I know.
Like,
I want to build
process.
Up. All right, so what happened was the new Fantastic Four movie came out, and it's atrocious.
Right.
But the Roger Corman's produced Fantastic Four movie from 1995
right.
was, I don't know if you want to say leaked, but Cole's had a bootleg copy of it forever.
Is that a terrible thing?
Yes.
Nicole, we're going to get to a discussion of what really is terrible when it comes to dealing with the Fantastic Four.
So it's online.
No, that's pretty bad.
I watched it online, the entire thing. And so let's start off by first giving an overview of the Fantastic Four.
Mm-hmm.
Who wants to give me basically the quick elevator pitch of what the Fantastic Four are?
A group of explorers and scientists that are also a family.
Imaginauts.
Yes. All rocket into space because of bad life decisions and get irradiated by cosmic energy, and then they get superpowers, and one of their ex-roommates is a total D-bag and is constantly trying to kill them. There you go.
All right. So
is that your interpretation of the Stanley Jack Kirby original premise?
Sure.
Oh, interesting.
And Fantastic Four, I mean, the comics started in 1961. Are they still in production? Like,
this exact moment, no.
There
but
is no Fantastic
were,
Four.
Like 2 months ago, it's just Secret Wars really. Still happening.
Oh, okay.
Well, and the Fantastic Four will be on different teams in different areas. They're kind of spread out. And
the
then
what used to be
exist.
An anchor book, what used to be a core of the Marvel Universe, and a book that donned the Silver Age of comic books, no longer exists because. There's my theory is the infighting around the movies, and that's
a good theory.
I mean, I've read a couple of bits online about it, and I stand by this that they are you know, they sunk their flagship book to diminish the popularity of the characters and the viability of them as marketable movie characters.
Little did they know they didn't need to do that.
Little did they know.
Cares.
I mean,
it's not a moneymaker. It never has been, at least not for the past decade. So it's one of those things that everybody getting like up in arms about the conspiracy is just like, look, it's a creative property that doesn't make that much money. Let them do whatever they want to do. You know, it's like.
Would you say like the Allred stuff that happened like what is a year or two ago was that like the better seller?
The Hickman was probably the better seller.
Oh, that's
and coming
good
off
point.
Of the Hickman run, probably. I mean, they probably still maintained a little bit, but not as well.
That's true.
But the Hickman stuff and the Fantastic Four, that all funneled into that was all part of his story building process into Secret Wars.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. You know, and so I have to kind of disagree with you there about the you know, maybe they're not making money, but as far as like the viability of those iconic characters in the Marvel Universe. That's what causes me some concern and befuddlement as I was looking at that preview of the post-Secret Wars publication plan. And there's no Fantastic Four. And
well,
there has always been a Fantastic Four
I think
book.
It Marvel viability and money are the same word. Mm-hmm. So
let me put it this way.
Then that's good point. True for DC.
Let me put it this way.
All right.
A few years back, Marvel straight up killed Thor.
Uh-huh.
He was gone for 5 years. He wasn't around for any events.
Okay.
That was fine.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't lose any money. And people were like, okay,
and
we're taking a vacation. And then 5 years later, he comes back and everyone cares because we all realize, oh, it's been a while. I want to see Thor again.
Really
look at
point.
It that way.
Okay. Yeah.
Like, really we're still going to get Ben Grimm in the Guardians of the Galaxy.
Totally.
And we're still going to get Human Torch in the Inhuman titles because he's shacking up with Medusa. And, you know, we'll probably get Reed if he survives Doctor Doom during Secret Wars. So it's just kind of like, we'll see them again.
Oh, I have no doubt of that. It's just that the way they've been sidelined and scattered to the wind.
Their nature is to be sidelined. Sorry, this is, their titles just never had momentum.
Okay.
Not significant momentum. There's a reason the flagship characters are Spider-Man and Wolverine, usually.
Okay.
So it's like,
But it's interesting how all the movies have been sort of these big
public failures. Except for the first one, 1994's Fantastic Four, produced by Roger Corman, written by Ole Sassoon, I think is his name. And apparently this movie was it was funded and produced without the intention of ever being released.
No.
What happened was the guy who in the studio had the rights, and he had to begin production of the movie before he lost the rights to
it. There's actually, I watched an episode of a show on YouTube called The Best of the Worst. And these four fellas, not unlike what we do here, but with a great deal less charm. They watch a series of bad movies and discuss them. And I sat down with some friends, with my lovely friends, Nick Rykar and Amy Lazert, and we watched them talk about the Salinger Captain America movie, the Supergirl movie, and Corman's Fantastic Four. And they were kind of comparing, you know, what is the best of the worst. And their takeaway was, and I have to agree with them, that it is far more charming than any of the other awful superhero films that were made. But they were also trying to give us some backstory that's still a little bit muddy, but there was like a German film production company or a German investor who had been holding on to the rights and to just eke out that time a little bit more.
I don't know the name. I don't know his name, but right. It is very, very German.
So he basically hired Roger Corman to produce this film, and nobody involved with the production knew that they had no intention of releasing it. I mean, they did press junkets. I remember publicity photos. There was a trailer in the movie theaters, the whole kit and caboodle.
It's weird. It's one of those movies where it was produced, like, you know, released in 19 or not released. It was finished, I guess, in 1994.
Right.
But
it looks like it was made in 1982.
I told you this, or maybe not.
I stole your thunder.
No, it's a great lead-in. If I had watched this movie not knowing that it was made in the mid-90s, if somebody had told me this is a great cult film from, like, 1979, I would have loved it.
Made
I would have been
TV
like,
movie.
This is so charming.
It was movie of the week, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's got
on
the
CBS.
The Human Torch, like, he chases down a laser. We didn't need to get into that. But, and it's so cartoony. Mm-hmm. It's like, because it's like they took a scene from the Fantastic Four cartoon from 1964.
Mm-hmm. Have you guys seen it?
Yeah.
You've seen it.
I've seen, like, bits and pieces.
That's enough. Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is plenty. Yeah.
No, years ago, I remember seeing, like, a bootleg copy and then, like, probably parts of it another time. And I sat down when Ben sent the link to the leaked version and tried watching the entire thing. I fast-forwarded a lot of that. I always remember since I was younger, the first time I saw it, there's a scene at the end where Dr. Doom falls off the side of his castle and, you know, they do the whole horrible grab my hand, Victor, no kind of thing. And then, like, the gauntlet is left on the castle wall or whatever. And the gauntlet comes to life. And I just remember tuning out and being like, I'm out. Nope. Don't
so
need
out.
That. Yeah. I don't need that in my Doctor Doom. Nope. See you later.
But they did that all the time, like in the Burn stories, where like the mask came to life and like, you know, tore up the joint. I think the mask, an animated mask with its sub, you know, routines, destroyed the entire Baxter Building. They did stuff like that all the time in the comic books.
Yeah, it was just the way it was done.
Doombots, Chris.
I know.
It's also unfair to be ragging on Roger Corman's Fantastic Four because it was never released. You know, we're watching it. It wasn't intended to be watched.
Nope.
So let's move on to 2005's Fantastic Four, starring Jessica Alba and some other people.
Chiklis.
Michael Chiklis as Ben Grimm.
So, see, that's the thing. I love Michael Chiklis.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, like, The Shield is one of my favorite TV shows.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had the special privilege of watching all the Fantastic Four movies in order because I'd never seen the Jessica Alba Fantastic Four movies.
Wow.
So I watched them recently. My brother-in-law actually had the DVDs, so I was able to borrow them. Oh yeah, because I asked you if you had them too.
Yeah.
You can't find the Fantastic Four movies on iTunes. I have no idea why.
Oh, well.
So
probably because the ownership of that is so, you know, is it Fox has got that nailed down so tight.
It wasn't. I don't think it did very well, but it did merit a sequel. But let's talk about the first Fantastic Four movie. Not the first. The 2005 Fantastic Four.
The Tim Story. He directed.
Yeah, Tim Story.
He directed both of them. I enjoyed the first one for what it was. I thought it was. There's a tone to the Fantastic Four that is fun, is charming. They're a family. If you read the old Kirby, I over the last 10 years, I'd collected the big phone book editions of the Kirby Lee original stories. And I had no idea how light and silly they could be, and just how fun. But also, there's this tone of family that runs through it that I never had really been subjected to. Because I think I started in on Fantastic Four in the 80s with John Byrne, when he was incorporating, you know, all of his kookiness into how he told his stories. Excuse me.
And it was very much a I was surprised at the slapstickiness of the movie, and apparently that light, you know, that lightheartedness comes from the comics, but I just thought, you know, they wanted I read on IMDb's trivia that the producers wanted to very much infuse this movie with a bunch of comedy, and I think sometimes it just didn't work.
Yeah, it's one of those things of I really, out of everything out of those movies, the next two, the first one here in the sequel, I always did like the interpretation of the Human Torch and the Ben Grimm. I actually really like the practical effects they used on Chiklis, and I like the fact that the two of them were basically kind of like brothers that bullied each other and all that. So that held up well for me.
I also liked that the Human Torch was Captain America.
Yeah. Chris Evans worked for both roles, but the movie falls apart again for me at Doctor Doom. So this is the thing. Doctor Doom's like my favorite Marvel character, hands down, and I actually think that the most important thing about the Fantastic Four is that they introduced Doctor Doom to the Marvel universe, because he's like the villain for the entire universe. Like, he is such a interesting character that he works when he's just fighting Spider-Man, the X-Men, whoever, you know. So it's one of those things that the moment you can't get him right, something is wrong, because he's such a simple character that you shouldn't be able to screw that up. So like, I actually like the guy that they cast for it, but the moment they decided to give him powers and they put the mask on, they even like did his voice weird, it just like, this is just dumb to me. Right. And then the movie just fell apart after that.
I have to agree. I have to agree.
It's Julian McMahon from Nip Tuck.
Which I thought was perfect until he became Doom.
Yeah.
He worked as Victor, didn't work as Doom.
And when they did the Ultimate Fantastic Four stories, they did weird things with him as well.
It's renamed him Victor Van Damme, and then they gave him goat legs.
Right. The comic book went off on a weird direction.
I don't know how you could go forward with that. Like, because just hearing you say that, I feel like there should be a boardroom of people like,
No.
It was a focus group that gave him goat legs. And, no, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Do you think that the ultimate, is it Ultimate Spider-Man, where Doom shows up in that cartoon? Do you think that they did a good job on Doom there?
I'm trying to remember. I know I saw those, but I can't quite remember them right now.
He's really fierce. Like, he just shows up, and it's just like, oh, okay, kids, that's really cute. I'm going to show you that you can't really actually defeat me.
Yeah.
But so, that's real cute that you're trying.
Cartoons kind of generally get him better.
Yeah. And it seems really simple there and very effective.
Because he showed up in the Avengers Assemble, didn't he?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah,
it's been a little while since
yes, he did. Yeah. Well, it's, you know, he's a character, he's a bad guy who's, he's the prototype for Darth Vader. He's the armored villain, and he's most successful when it's less is more. You know, he's a master of science and sorcery, and I think, you know, depending on who's writing him, they downplay the sorcery aspect, or the fact that his mother was a sorceress.
Yeah.
Sorry?
A gypsy.
A gypsy sorceress kind of person.
See, the part that works for me is that he's the hero to the story according to him.
Right.
And, like, he's not the pure evil villain who's just like, oh, hi, I'm evil. Mm-hmm. But he's also not just a base criminal. He's the guy who actually will show up and do something good, especially if it helps him out. But, like, if somebody put, like, a dying child in front of him, he'd save the kid.
Right.
Because he thinks he's the hero and he wants to be seen as the hero.
Best
but then
villains.
Richards, curse that Richards, gets in his way and he's got to probably kill the guy. You know, and he's technically the hero of Secret Wars to a degree right now. So it's like, that's why I love him as a character.
Well, that's why the Secret Wars story fascinates me, because they've blown up that notion of him being the hero of his own story to the nth degree, because he's God.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
But back to the movies.
Lord God,
yeah, yeah. So 2005's Fantastic Four did well enough to merit a sequel, 2007's Fantastic Four and the Rise of the Silver Surfer.
But,
which I, you know, when I was thinking about Fantastic Four on the podcast, I forgot or I just gloss over it, that Silver Surfer was a Fantastic Four movie. And so I'm like, hey, let's talk about all three of them. Cole's like, we all four of them, right? So
that one is actually miserable. I really don't care for that movie at all. And the big issue is introducing the way they went about introducing the Silver Surfer, because you can't have the Silver Surfer without Galactus.
And well, what I heard was that that was actually a preemptive thing for another movie.
Yes.
And the Storm Cloud was just the coming of Galactus, and then we were going to...
I actually did an interview with the director decades
ago. Oh, do you have your notes in front of you about that?
I have my notes in front of me, yeah.
Well, do you... anything
talking
relevant?
To Cole. I'll find... This is back in 2007 when I talked to Tim Story for Box Office Magazine, and I went and found the transcripts of the interview. So... I wanted to find the bit where I did ask him about why is there no Galactus.
Yeah.
But I don't want to have to... okay. I found it. Shall I read it?
Continue.
Are you all right?
Lay it on us, man.
I asked him, you know, in Fantastic Four Rise of the Silver Surfer, we meet the Silver Surfer for the first time. But unlike the comic book stories, his lord and overseer Galactus is all but eliminated from the story. Why was this? And he said, Tim Story said... the executive creative, just like any other aspect of an executive creative realm in a movie, there was going to be a spinoff to a Silver Surfer film, which we already knew. And he says, we made the choice early on to have something for that Silver Surfer story, and it was Galactus. Galactus does appear in the film, but he's shrouded in clouds because, quite frankly, we didn't know how he was going to look in the spinoff.
But they get the little horn.
Do we see the little horn?
You see the shadow.
You see the shadow of his helmet.
So only those who knew, right?
But I was so disappointed that I just said, why bother?
Yeah. So Story said, so one, we didn't want to tie up the hands of the studio and or whatever filmmakers who wound up doing the other movie. And two, we didn't want to take it over and bring Galactus in at a certain point and then not be able to finish it.
And then they didn't finish it.
Because they did miserably at the box office.
Yeah, he had a little bit of foresight there. At one point, we had to take the initiative and say, let's save something for the other movie. I mean, what we eventually created was a curiosity about the other story. It was really about not taking away the choices of that other movie, which is being written as we speak, he said, in 2007.
See, I find it interesting that you dislike that one and think it's the worst one, when I think universally everyone disagrees. It's the other way around. I think I had just seen those numbers on Rotten Tomatoes, and like the rating system rises on that one quite a bit.
There were cosmetic things about it that I found to be really distasteful, like... the casting of Jessica Alba was always, you know, and putting this Hispanic woman in a blonde wig and giving her these, for some reason, those blue contacts were so much more fake
in
the
sequel. Her eyes looked weird.
In the sequel than they were in the first one.
Were those contact lenses?
Oh, goodness, yes. I mean, she's got Hispanic American. Yeah. She's got very dark eyes and dark hair and dark complected skin.
Never seen anything else she's done.
What?
I haven't.
You never watched Dark Angel? You never watched James Cameron? Honey?
Did you ever see Sin City?
I did see Sin City. Yeah. I couldn't tell what color her eyes were in
that one. Yeah. So,
are we looking at the color of eyes in movies here? Because I feel like I've not been doing my job now. I don't know.
I just remember, I figured she was wearing blue contact lenses, or maybe they did something in post where they just amplified the blueness of her eyes. But I normally don't pay attention to that kind of, especially when it's on somebody like Jessica Alba. But it struck me as odd.
You know, sometimes a film can get away with some things in my mind, in my heart. It can get away with some things in the first outing. And the second outing, you expect them to go one better, or at least to have improved or matured in their process. I didn't see that in the second Fantastic Four film.
I actually liked the second one better than I did the first one, because I was waiting, because with all of these reboots, you're like, you gotta, like you mentioned earlier, you gotta get past the origin story.
Yes.
We know how Superman became Superman. Let's just see them fight people.
Yeah.
So I was excited to see the Fantastic Four already, like, as the Fantastic Four and going on an adventure. And
something
cool. I was just gonna say, which brings us to
We move on to the next one, what were you gonna say?
Well, no, I read a few articles about, like, can we ever get a good Fantastic Four movie, and what would that be for people?
Right.
And I read a bunch of different ideas, but the one that I always came to me was just like, just start with action.
Yeah.
And start the movie with Doom, a fully functional Doom. And have the first 10 minutes just be them fighting the hell out of Doom. And then let the rest of the movie through good directing, tell you the origin through like a bunch of news reports because they're celebrities now. So they, you could have Ben Grimm walk by the street and there'd be like, these four went into space because of bad life decisions. And then just like get it down and then get to Annihilus or get the Blastar, get to some other villain.
The Mole
so,
Man.
Blastar, yeah, that'd get the be cool.
Mole.
Yeah,
so get the movie just going at full speed because they're about explorers. It's a sci-fi, crazy superhero thing. And then just fill us in. Like, do you guys remember, like, in Shaun of the Dead, the only way you learn about the fact that the zombie apocalypse happened, other than zombies show up, is there's a quick TV scene where, like, yes, every person is like, and right, da, burp, 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 and they, yes, cut. Like, do something like that. Don't waste my time.
Yeah.
And the Fantastic Four have such cool effects. Their superhero powers are, yeah, really cool that you could really focus on that through the action scenes, and that would be, like, really spectacular.
Yeah. Have the first scene be the thing punching Doom through a wall.
Yeah.
And then boom, action, action, action.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Rest of the plot.
I want to watch that,
you know,
movie.
Doom isn't in the rest of the movie because I know some people are like, oh, it doesn't have to be about Doom. It's just like, you know, it kind of does. But put him in the beginning, move on to the next villain.
Well, that is obviously not, mm-hmm, what happened with 2015's Fantastic Four, directed by Josh Trank. This movie, so I saw this movie. For science.
You saw for it science, because I put you to
by,
the test.
For
I
mean, duty.
You. By science, I mean for the podcast. I went to see this downtown, at the downtown movie theater here in Seattle, 9:30 p.m. on a Monday, and I was the only one in the theater up until like after the preview started rolling, and I thought that was great. I'm like, because that's never happened to me before. I've
really?
Never been the only one in a movie theater.
Gosh,
so like, I was
like five times.
I was getting ready to enjoy that, and then like two or three couples came in, and one couple came in and sat like right behind me, 10 to 15 minutes after the movie started. I'm
why
like,
do
what?
People do that?
I think what they were doing is that another movie had ended and they just walked down the hall. So anyway, I saw that movie.
Do still do that in,
yep,
in movies?
Especially in this theater.
In
the
multiplexes?
It's happened.
The Regal 16 down in Seattle. Don't do it, kids. Buy your tickets.
You'll get busted.
Anyway.
You'll get sent to jail.
I'm a pretty easy movie audience member. Like, I can find a way to enjoy anything. This movie was dull and boring, and it looked pretty, but the actors were pretty solid,
yes,
and cardboardish. Yeah. And about what you're saying about just get to the story. This started off with
we start off with Reed Richards like 6 years old.
Yeah, and
wow.
Ben Grimm's a classmate. Yeah, and Homer Simpson's their teacher, the voice of Homer Simpson.
Right.
Dan Castellaneta is their teacher.
I was. Mm-hmm.
And so okay, so I'm like, all right, so we're doing, you know, Reed Richards' backstory, and so we go to him in high school, and we meet him in a high school science fair, and Dan Castellaneta again is like, you know, you fail. And he meets Franklin Storm,
right,
and Sue Storm.
Right.
And then I'm totally expecting another like flash forward, mm-hmm, because is this the Fantastic 14-year-olds? What's going on here? But no, it's I'm like, because I see Reed, I see, you know, Mr. Fantastic. He's got like the white, you know, temples, mm-hmm, and that never happened in this one.
Nope,
and I'm like,
because
he's 18.
Because they want to appeal to a younger demographic,
and they succeeded at this. And initially I thought it was going to be the Ultimates Fantastic Four kind of story, because those comics were designed, constructed to you know, be aimed toward a younger audience, so they clearly were not written for them as time progressed. This movie, the new Fantastic Four movie, the Josh Trank movie, I was with it for the first 15 plus minutes. I was like, I don't know what the head slapping's about, the face palming's about, because I am thoroughly enjoying this. And then by the time we get to the Baxter building and we start setting up the characters, I'll just say it. I had misgivings about the colorblind casting of the characters because they are traditionally all white. And I'm like, you know what? Didn't matter. I actually found the casting, the gentleman who plays Franklin Storm, superb. And I was watching it like I watched Trank's previous film, Chronicle. I'm like, he's going to retell Chronicle with a bigger budget. And I enjoyed Chronicle. It's these dispossessed kids with superpowers. He's going to have a chance to, you know, expand on those ideas. Maybe that's why everybody's grumping about this movie. And then it just went south. It just fell apart. And a lot of people are claiming it's because of studio influence, but I don't know.
There's a lot of talk about speculation going around. Josh Trank apparently had some behavior issues on set.
Okay. Well, yeah. He tweeted some.
He tweeted something that like got immediately taken down, but you know, the internet's the internet, so somebody was able to snapshot it.
Right.
Where he was just like, well, sometimes you make a movie and then a year later it's not the same movie because of people. Right. You know, and you're like, aha.
And like, is there somebody online who's taking a screenshot of every single tweet that's up there? It seems like whenever a tweet gets taken down,
there's actually, I think, a website dedicated to like, like it's a timeline of tweets. Whenever something happens that's controversial, certain people can go in there and record an entire tweet cycle. So you could read the history of a dialogue.
Wow.
And that's happening a lot now. So
Well, this film got grim and so, pardon the pun. Okay, I'm sorry. Dreary. All right. It got frustratingly dreary because by the time about the halfway mark, I didn't care about any of these people. And the positioning of how we, you know, in this story, we don't go to outer space and get irradiated by cosmic rays. It's more like the ultimate story. We go to an alternate universe where we're doing dimension hopping. That's fine. That's a fine translation. In this story, it's Ben, Johnny, Reed, and Victor who go to the other dimension, and they leave Susan behind.
That was one major argument I read
they
online.
They leave the other scientists behind, but they take the hot-headed brother who has no background in science, and they take the buddy. They take Ben Grimm, who in this story isn't even a pilot. He doesn't even drive a garbage truck. Reed just goes and grabs him in a drunken whim because, hey, you're my buddy.
They're best friends.
You got to come with me on this trip because you've been there all the time. Mm. And there was a moment where I'm like, okay, I'm kind of buying this, that, you know, in a drunken moment of hopefulness, this kind of thing could happen. But not for long. Anyway, keep going, Ben.
Also, well, I mean, when I was watching Michael Chiklis portray the thing, and I read that he like, pushed for the thing's costume to be practical.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And watching the movies, I'm like, I don't know, maybe it's just kind of weird, because all I'm seeing is Michael Chiklis in a rubber costume. Mm-hmm. But watching this movie and the CGI thing, I'm like, man, I'm missing Michael Chiklis in a thing costume.
Practical effects, man. It's just the fact that there's a human, that you can see other humans interacting with a human.
Yep. Yeah.
And, I mean, sometimes there's a guy in a green suit in place of a human, and that works great if you're a... Andy Serkis, but otherwise it's just kind of like, no man, there's just a certain level where I need the person to be there. And there's a lot of like the old comics where Ben Grimm's not that tall. He's actually kind of like some people, normal people are taller than him. So I like the idea that he's not this giant monster.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes I do, but so it's just kind of like whenever I see the effects on this, I'm just like, bleh.
Yeah, it was dreary, like you said. It was dreary. And there's no, like, at the very end, you're like, all right, well, that just ended.
No.
Well, and the way they end the film is like, here is your secret laboratory, and here's all the equipment, and the future is yours, Fantastic Four. And they come up with their name, and it's this cute little moment. And I'm like, I have no interest in seeing where these people go. I'm sorry. And I do believe this, even though it's been a financial disaster, have they not slated the sequel?
I don't know. I don't know.
They have. Because this movie's going to make bank overseas.
Maybe.
No, it'll make bank overseas.
All right. Anyway, do we have any final thoughts about, okay, what I wanted to bring up, and you brought this up earlier, Chris, was what can we do to make a good Fantastic Four movie? And I'm with you there. I think the Fantastic Four franchise should be given to some... like Korean director who specializes in martial arts movies.
Snowpiercer or something. Yeah.
Jim Bung Ha.
Yeah.
Or some absurdist like Takashi Miike. You know, I'd love to see Takashi Miike.
I disagree.
Four.
I'm gonna agree
with me, sir.
No, I'm gonna disagree.
I won't drive you home.
Yeah, my car's in the shop. I got rear-ended. My car is broken.
Oh.
I am in agreement with Chris on starting on the action. I think traditionally Hollywood has wasted so much time and energy and space on giving us an origin story or retelling an origin story or telling their version of the origin story. I'm in agreement on that. But I think that what is missing from all these Fantastic Four films, except the Corman one, is charm. And there's a facet of this film. The other aspect that's missing is family. Because the Fantastic Four is a family. They're a family of oddballs. And they try so hard to do that in this Trank film. Franklin has lines about, we're family. And I'm like, these are beautiful pieces of dialogue that mean nothing because you didn't build any of this around it.
I think the focus, the smart focus might be to have them be explorers who happen to be family. Because the demographics aren't just quite skewing the right way to what they're trying to get to. But what I would like to see for the plot would be you open with the action, you open with the big villain, mm-hmm. you immediately go into them like trying to decompress, and then, wait, that's right, we're explorers. We just found the negative zone. Boom. Oh, we pissed off an annihilus. Mm-hmm. And there's the rest of the movie right there. Like, sure. It doesn't take much. You know, it's fairly easy. So, I don't know. Is there something you'd like to see, Nicole? Black Panther.
A movie I want to see. Yeah, because I don't care Galactus. About any of these. I really don't. I just kind of... I did not take any initiative for the podcast. I just didn't have it in me, so...
You didn't appreciate that Galactus was just a big gaseous cloud?
No, I really didn't. Yeah. I didn't appreciate it at all.
All right. Well, that's Fantastic Four. Let's go on to book report. Nicole, what have you been reading this week?
So nothing to do with Fantastic Four. I read Archie number one.
Awesome.
Yeah. And it's written by Mark Waid and Fiona Staples. And it was a really solid first issue. It was really fun. I loved the artwork. It starts off with Archie and Betty. They had dated. They were kind of like the it couple, and now they're split up. Don't really know why. There's the lipstick incident, whatever that is. He's also like a guitar player, but he's very shy, and then he gets kind of put into a position where he ends up playing and really likes it, and it's one of those like, I don't know if I want to run away and hide forever or do this for the rest of my life. I can't tell. So I don't know. So that's just like the only thing that I was questioning in the issue. Anyway, so that I'm getting a little sidetracked here.
So how well is it selling?
It's selling really well. It's selling really well.
Can I find the first print of the first issue, or is it too late?
We have them right here behind me. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It was number...
It's right behind you.
It was number 7 of the top 200 sales chart for July.
Because it's the one they were trying to do the Kickstarter with that we talked about months
yep.
ago.
And
right?
I will say they should have continued with the Kickstarter because they've already lost Fiona Staples. She's off at number 3.
Yep.
Because these people who are popular that will increase your sales cost money.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, Nicole, do you feel like it's got the strength of Mark Waid's writing is going to...
I think they're a great team, and I really wish that they could have kept going. I mean, I've only read issue 1, but it was really sweet that I automatically cared about everybody. I was confused about the potential Kevin Keller character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
because,
Kevin.
Because... he wanted to do some shady business with the votes, and I don't feel like Kevin Keller would be okay with that. But I don't know. Maybe I don't know Kevin Keller very well. Mm. That was great. I think it's great. I think they should keep going. There's going to be more. Like, the Jughead one has been solicited, and so that's going to be fun because Jughead is really fun in this one. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I definitely recommend it. And
awesome. Archie. All right. Chris, what did you read?
I read a new Boom title called Welcome Back. It's a 4-issue miniseries. It is written by Christopher Sabella, illustrated by Jonathan Brandon Sawyer. And just because I like this name, it's colored by Carlos Zamudio. It's a lot of fun. It's a really kinetic and dirty art style. When I say dirty, I mean like a lot of cross-hatching. And it's a little busy, but it's very dynamic. And the idea to it is that it starts off with a series of flashbacks of people murdering each other, and apparently they've been murdering each other for like centuries. They're resurrected each time, and they hunt each other down. And then
and there can only be one.
Yeah, maybe. and then there's like the main character is a young girl who, you know, she's unemployed, she's in debt, she doesn't quite like her life, she has nightmares, and apparently her father was a famous serial killer, or her stepfather, so everyone hounds her for that. But then there's a whole nother sub-story of like these secret people and the secret war, and she's apparently part of it through the whole resurrection stuff. But they actually start really plotting out, like, there's different roles within the war. There's grunts, there's soldiers, there's guides who basically plan the whole thing out, and no one really knows why they're at war anymore. So it's like they've been doing it since the beginning of time. So it's a fun, interesting idea.
How far into the series?
Issue number 1 of 4. Right. It just came out this last week.
All right, so it's a limited.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Okay. Yeah.
Welcome back, and all I can think of is welcome back, Cotter. All right, Cole Hornaday.
Hey, yes. Well, I've read the third issue of DC's Constantine the Hellblazer, as opposed to the original series. It was Constantine Hellblazer. You know what I neglect to do? I just realized is that I never mentioned the writers and artists. I just kind of like launch into my, you know, particularly useless opinions about the book. This is written by Ming Doyle and James Tynion IV. I just love both their names. Ming Doyle. She's a spy, or he's a spy, a super spy.
She.
Got it right the first time. And then Ming Doyle and Vanessa Del Rey, the artists. I got to tell you, I am really pleased with how they're rebuilding John Constantine. I'm having a lot of fun with this book.
It's worth noting that the original artist is already apparently gone. Guy who launched it. Maybe he'll come back, but the artist of the issue you're holding there is not who was supposed to be the regular artist.
Okay. Well, it's not affected my reading pleasure. What I am enjoying is that, you know, I have gotten into fist fights with my arch nemesis, the Contrarian, about how John Constantine has been depicted in film and the recent comic book rendition and in the Dark Justice League and all that silliness. And I'm really intrigued because I feel like they're going back to the egg on this and rebuilding his character. That is still Machiavellian, that is still of questionable merit, worth, you know, why is he there? Why do people turn to him? Is he in it for himself, or is he actually a heroic figure? And I'm enjoying it, and it's still crude and icky and creepy and kinky, and it's not a Vertigo book. You know, it's still, I think for all intents and purposes, still lives in the post-52 universe. So, so far, so good. I'm enjoying this quite a bit.
Cool.
All right. Constantine, so if the Contrarian has anything he wants to say to Cole, you can email us at perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. And that's our show. But before we go, we play quiz time to get your quiz hats on, everybody. Today's questions are all about the Fantastic Four, of course, because that's what dominated the show today. So, number one, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby created the Fantastic Four in 1961 in response to DC's success with what title? Chris.
Justice League of America?
Yes, sir. Number two, Miles Teller, who plays Reed Richards in 2015's Fantastic Four, holds what distinction amongst the previous two actors who have played Mr. Fantastic? He holds what distinction amongst the previous two actors who have played Mr. Fantastic?
He's the youngest?
Well, there's that, but that's not the answer I have. He's American. Alex Hyde-White and I'm going to butcher his first name. I think it's Ian Griffith. Mm-hmm. They were both British. Conversely, the guy who plays Ben Grimm in this latest Fantastic Four is British, and all the previous two things are American. Number three. In 2007's Rise of the Silver Surfer, the surfer Norrin Radd speaks of the one I love. What is the name of Norrin Radd's girlfriend? Chris.
Shalabal?
Yes, sir.
Good job.
In 2005's Fantastic Four, what scene was added once Jessica Alba was cast as Sue Storm? I got this from the IMDb's trivia page.
Is there a shower scene or an underwear scene?
There is an underwear scene.
Yeah.
She's on the bridge and she's got to make herself invisible. So she's right. In her underwear.
Yeah.
Alrighty. And finally, 1994's Fantastic Four, produced by Roger Corman and directed by Ole Sassoon, as I'm sure we've mentioned by now, and we did, was never intended to be released. As Stan Lee mentioned to Kevin Smith during an interview, it was made only because the studio that owned the rights to make a Fantastic Four movie would have lost those rights if it did not begin production by a certain date. What other modern superhero movie rushed into production so that the studio could retain the film rights? Nicole's kind of putting her hand up. Chris
is just
a
guess at this point. It's a different movie than the Fantastic Four, because I feel like that's just what they keep doing anyway.
It is the Fantastic Four.
Okay. They did it with Spider-Man too, didn't they?
Yeah, I felt that they did.
They did it with Spider-Man and Fantastic Four.
Fox was up against the 7-year window before the characters reverted back to Marvel.
Whoa.
And that's quiz time. That's
Yay,
our show.
Quiz time.
All right. You can find us at perfectboundpodcast.com. You can also email us at perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. You can find everything Nicole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com. You can also come to the Comics Dungeon at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.